Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of why Bernie Sanders is not connecting with African-American voters compared with Hillary Clinton, who has swept the Southern Democratic primaries and is expected to win big in Mississippi today. Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington, who is the principal investigator of the multi-state survey on race and politics and is the author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America, joins us to discuss why African-American voters are not feeling the burn. Then we'll examine the underlying reasons why Donald Trump is winning over angry white working class voters, which, in a word, is globalism, the economic basis of voter anger that has been building for 40 years. Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, whose column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times. He joins us to discuss his recent article at the New York Times, Why Trump Now, and how Trump has mobilized a constituency with legitimate grievances, but is taking them on a fool's errand. Then finally, we'll look into why, all of a sudden, there are millions of socialists in America and speak with Harold Meyerson, an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post, about his latest article at The Guardian, Why Are There Suddenly Millions of Socialists in America? We'll discuss a 2011 Pew poll that indicated 49% of Americans under 30 have a positive view of socialism, while just 47% have a favorable opinion of capitalism. Findings that suggest Bernie Sanders did not push young people towards socialism, but they were already there. Joining us now is Chris Parker, a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He is the principal investigator of the multi-state survey on race and politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chris Parker.
Hey, Ian. Glad to be back.
And I'm waiting to get some results since the polls have just closed in Mississippi and most of the polls in Michigan have closed, although some don't close till 9 p.m. Eastern, which is 6 p.m. local time when we get off the air. But there's an expectation, of course, that Bernie Sanders is not going to do particularly well. 25% of the electorate, or at least the Democratic primary voters in Michigan, are African American, and over half in Mississippi are African American. So, is that a reasonable assumption that that Bernie's just not connecting with African American voters, whereas Hillary is?
That's a very reasonable assumption because, as I wrote in a piece on the conversation last week, it's called Why Bernie Will Burn Out in Dixie. It's just that, you know, he's not connecting because he's trying to frame everything in terms of class. And we all know, as sophisticated people, know that class and race overdetermine each other. There's just no question about that. But the problem is that black people tend to respond more to appeals that directly, you know, tap into race vis-a-vis class. Race is going to trump class. They're really, really related, but race is going to trump class every time among people of color, especially black people. So that's a principal issue with Bernie. And let me say one other thing, Ian. So the last time, one of the main times, you know, in the last 100 years, you know, when the last time another person tried to make these class-based appeals, right, on a mass level, if we go back to Franklin Roosevelt, who, you know, the New Deal, you know, that was basically a class-based solution, you know, to help people the most affected by the Great Depression. Black people were supposedly a part of that, but they were essentially written out of the New Deal by these policies that really, they help white people a lot more than black people. So class-based appeals just don't really work with black folks.
And what about the few that have joined him? I mean, is it just a case of being on the left or the far left in terms of his politics? I mean, you know, the way that most people see it, at least in terms of analysis, is the Bernie's to the left of Hillary. But that doesn't mean that African-Americans are more conservative than the rest of the electorate, does it?
No, not at all. So the people, the African Americans, or black folks, rather, I like to call us black folks, for various and sundry reasons.
Well, it's a lot easier. I'm with you there, Chris.
So look, the bottom line is that so there are some black folks who have endorsed him, like Cornel West, you know, Killer Mike, I guess the guy's name is. You know, there are several black folks that have endorsed him. But these are all, you know, black elites, right? These are all black folks, you know, who have a luxury of sitting back and thinking about class a lot. Whereas people that are black folks who are you know, in the middle class and beyond and below that, you know, it's about the everyday sort of material things. And a lot of that we see, and they see a lot of racism and discrimination, right? So Bernie's trying to talk about racism and discrimination, no question about that. I'm not going to gainsay his conversation on that, but it's always wrapped into a larger discourse on class. And that does not appeal to black folks. Second, black folks tend to be very, very pragmatic. Bernie has all these pie-in-the-sky ideas, but how do we get them done? There is no practical way to, he's not outlined any practical solution to these things, right? And black people tend to be very, very, very pragmatic.
And again, I'm speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington. And his latest book is Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. And at this point, CNN are projecting that Hillary Clinton is going to win big in Mississippi. That's hardly a surprise, is it?
Hey, let me tell you, Ian, I called this last week, right, when I said there's no way Bernie is going to come within shouting distance of Hillary. And part of that has to do with, was I think, one of the reasons why you have me on. So let me explain Hillary's appeal. So first of all, John Lewis, you know, a few weeks back saying, you know, he met Bill and Hillary Clinton, you know, way back in the day during the civil rights struggle, said he never saw Bernie Sanders. That's number one. So that suggests that Bernie's a Johnny come lately, if you will, you know, to the whole civil rights thing, you know, race and politics issues, right? So that's sort of one thing. And then two, you know, black people still, in spite of the crime bill, despite the Welfare Reform Act, you know, black folks still have a positive image. Black folks of a certain age, that is to say 40 and over, have a very positive recollection of Bill Clinton. And so Hillary's married to him. They're connected. And so, and then beyond that, Hillary worked, and it's well documented that Hillary worked on the Children's Defense Fund, right? Or I forgot the name of the organization. I think it was the Children's Defense Fund. With Marion Wright Edelman back in the day. And that has been well publicized. And a lot of black people know about that. And then more recently, you know, she was on stage with several of the mothers of black men who were slain by police. So she's out there front and center with these folks, right? And so Hillary really reaches out. She reaches out on a more personal level than Bernie. Bernie's talking about race and class. Hillary's down there at a more personal level, and that's something that appeals to black people.
But could it be that because Hillary and Bill, of course, spent so much time in Arkansas, that they're just simply more familiar with black folks? Than there's only 5,700 black folks in all of the state of Vermont.
Well, but see, Bernie did spend some time at the University of Chicago, and I was just telling one of my colleagues today, clearly, okay, University of Chicago, for people that don't know, is like an oasis on the south side of Chicago. I went to school there, so I know. And so if you go, so Hyde Park is an oasis. You got a lot of middle and upper middle class white folks who live there. University of Chicago is right in the middle of that. So, but on either side, on every side, it is bounded by the south side of Chicago, which is mainly black. So clearly Bernie didn't venture too far north of 43rd Street, nor did he venture too far south of 63rd. So he remained within this really strictly well-bounded community. Because if he had wandered outside of those perimeters, right, or that perimeter, he would have run into a lot of black people, and he would be a lot more familiar with us now.
So what do you think, though, is going to be the effect? Given that most black folks vote for Democrats, that's been pretty consistent now for decades. And the party of Lincoln, of course, is now looks like it's going to be headed by Donald Trump, who has said the most outrageous racist things about Muslims and Latinos. He's laid off African Americans, hasn't he? I mean, but that, what's your sense of what kind of, because one of the things I think the Democrats are counting on, I keep hearing that nobody's really confident that Hillary's going to do that well against Trump. But on the other hand, it's possible that some of the outrageous things Trump has said will mobilize people to come out and vote against him. So what's your thoughts on whether the African-American vote is going to be mobilized to vote against Trump?
Oh, it's definitely going to mobilize against Trump. I mean, think about it. I mean, so look, so people understand that if one tends to be, if one is anti-Semitic, if one is, if one is, you know, racist against Latinos, I mean, most people with common sense know that's a pretty, you know, these are, that is a common thread. So if they're intolerant on one dimension, they're probably going to be intolerant across dimensions, right? So which suggests that they, you know, black folks, well, I haven't seen any polling data on this yet, but to the extent that he didn't denounce, you know, David Duke in a timely way, that really raised the hackles of a lot of black folks. So even if it, so even if folks were skeptical, saying, "Oh, you know, he's saying that about Latinos, he's saying that about Muslims, maybe he doesn't feel this way about black people." The fact of the matter is, he didn't denounce David Duke in a timely fashion. So that was enough for most black folks to say, "Okay, this guy is probably racist, right?" Even if we had an inkling of it before, we know for sure now because he didn't completely repudiate David Duke in a timely way. So, and the social science shows that, you know, like, for example, in my work on the Tea Party, that the more black people knew about the Tea Party, the more information they had, the more they will mobilize in the 2010 midterm election. And the same thing happened when it came to Latinos and the Sensenbrenner bill in the late 1996 that spurred the Latino marches across the country against this Sensenbrenner bill that made it a felony to be a quote-unquote illegal immigrant, right? So whenever there's a sense of threat and injustice, minority communities will definitely mobilize. And so I expect that to be the case come November.
Well, we certainly had that a case of that in California a few years back when Governor Pete Wilson, a Republican, went after immigrants, Latino immigrants, in a very discriminatory way. And ever since then, the Latino vote in California has been almost exclusively Democrat. And there was an article in on the front page of Tuesday's New York Times saying that more and more Latinos are now, who've been here for a long time, who have green cards, are now getting citizenship because they want to vote against Trump.
Exactly. I was there in California when Prop 187 and Prop 202, I believe, were passed, and Latinos definitely got out and mobilized. And the same thing happened in the early 2000s with the Sensenbrenner bill. So yeah. So whenever you have any sort of threat, you know, to, you know, people of color, they will generally turn out at really high rates. Look at what happened in Ohio when they tried to pass these voter ID laws. Right. That really turned out. That really got the black vote out in 2012.
So in terms of I know we 50% of the vote, as I mentioned, in Mississippi is likely to go, the African American vote is likely to go for Hillary, and 25% of the vote African, well, 25% of the vote in Michigan is African American. It's also likely to go to Hillary, so it's likely to be a pretty big night for her. But that doesn't mean that Bernie's not going to stay in the race. There's some more states coming up in the next few days. And, of course, and a week from today, there's on the 15th, there's some big states, Florida and Ohio. So, you know, she's got about 672 delegates to 477 for Sanders, which doesn't seem like a big spread. But when you put in the super delegates, suddenly her total balloons to 1,130 to Sanders 499. He just has 22 super delegates. So my sense is that that's not going to play well. It's almost going to be like what could happen in with the Republicans if they go after Trump or trying to take it away from Trump in some kind of backroom maneuver. It's likely to explode in their face, and I've even heard Republicans say that there's going to be blood in the streets of Cleveland like there was in 68 at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. But equally true, it's not going to be good if somehow the superdelegates take it for Hillary. Do you think there's a way for Bernie to stay in the race? Because he could get a big haul later in April in New York, which is a pretty liberal state, and California, which I think is leaning heavily for Bernie. That's later in June. But by then, a lot of pundits say it won't matter, that she'll have it wrapped up.
Yeah, so look, sort of Hillary being indicted for treason for some reason, it's not going to happen. I'm fairly certain Bernie does not have a chance. She's gonna blow him out, super delegates or not. He's gonna lose pretty big. Now he might pick up, you know, he'll pick up some delegates here in the state of Washington. He'll definitely pick up some in California and Oregon, you know, as we swing west. But beyond that, beyond the West and the Northeast, it's not happening.
Well, the latest, the results are starting to trickle in here. Trump's got an early lead in Mississippi. There's no surprise there.
Right.
With less than 1% counted, Kasich and Trump are tied in Michigan, and Bernie is leading 52-47%. So I don't know whether that's a harbinger of an upset there, but. Obviously.
Well, 1%, and I would like to see what precincts are reporting right now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I know.
And I would imagine once it gets around Detroit, things are probably going to turn around a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's hardly a scientific sampling, so we shouldn't even. I just wanted to stay at least keep one eye on what was happening. But in general, I guess in terms of the diagnosis you've given us. There's not much that Bernie can do to change the perceptions. They're already pretty much in there, aren't they?
Yeah, they're pretty much they're already pretty much baked in. And then Bernie pretty much put his foot in his mouth the other night talking about the ghetto and, you know, being poor, but connecting, you know, poverty and being black, and it's just. He's just, you know, for someone, you know, who was already having trouble connecting, he was a little bit indelicate on that, you know, making that connection. And which is not to say that it's not there, because it's there, but for someone already having those issues, he probably should have been a little more circumspect when he made those comments. And it's just hurting him. It's just hurting him even more. So it's just not going to be fixed with black folks. It's just not going to help. And the only sort of way that he might have a chance is if black folks don't turn out, in these primaries. But the sad fact of the matter is for him is that we are turning out in these primaries because part of the reason I think we're turning out is because of Trump's prominence. If Trump weren't so prominent and if he weren't in the lead and if he weren't a threat, you know, from a GOP, then I don't think you would see black folks turning out in the numbers we are.
But the people that are turning out for Bernie are the young, and that's pretty much across the board. You know, they're a pretty, you know, diverse coalition of young people, because the young people today are much less interested in, or at least they're described as being post-sexual and post-racial. They don't have the kind of hang-ups that older generations have about race and gender. So at least that's a big constituency. And I guess just at the end of the day, as we wrap up, Chris, that's a constituency that it could be the future of the Democratic Party, surely.
Well, it could be, but the issue is relative to people who are middle-aged and older, young people are not nearly as politically engaged. So, yeah, there's all this Bernie fever. They're feeling the burn now, you know, but, if, you know, the problem for Hillary that if Bernie doesn't, you know, if Bernie doesn't sign off on Hillary, doesn't endorse her, which I imagine he will, you know, that it's going to be really hard to get them to turn out. And so that might be an issue. But what makes it a little hard or easier to swallow is that the fact of the matter is that young people just as a general rule aren't as politically engaged as older folks. And so, you know, they rarely really play a big part in elections, right, relative to people who are middle-aged and older, because there's a lot more at stake. We tend to be more engaged, yada, yada, yada. So, it's good that they're turning out, but at this point, I wouldn't get too excited about it.
Well, Chris, apparently you're provoking lots of angry callers who are mad at Hillary. And since most of our listeners are on the left and the far left, or at least a lot of them are, that's something that we can both ponder on. Why the Hillary haters on the left? I mean, there are plenty of them on the right, but this is a new phenomenon.
Yeah, a lot on the right, but you got a lot on the left, too.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for joining us, Chris Parker. I appreciate it.
No worries. Look forward to doing it again, Ian.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Chris Parker, who's a professor of social justice and political science at the University of Washington. He's the principal investigator of the Multi-State Survey on Race and Politics and the director of the Center for Survey Research at the University of Washington and author of Change They Can't Believe In, The Tea Party and Reactionary Politics in America. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the underlying reasons why Donald Trump is winning over the angry white working class voters.
Top, they are telling you still. But first, you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill, a working class hero.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, where he has a recent op-ed, Why Trump Now? Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Edsel.
Good to be with you.
And why Trump now? I mean, you've laid out the case, and it's pretty clear that what dominates most of Trump's speeches, apart from his sort of casual insults to all and sundry, is that he rails against trade deals. And I'm astounded as to why the Democrats don't get it. I mean, they wrung their hands over so-called Reagan Democrats back in the 80s, and now they're just blaming the electorate and not blaming themselves.
Well, it's difficult, one, for Hillary to back off from a lot of trade deals that she in the past has supported. And I suspect that if she were to win, she would be supportive of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Trump has tapped into, by adopting this position, which is much more anti-trade than Republican candidates have been in the past, has really tapped into a strong feeling among those Reagan Democrats who actually have much more animosity to trade than people expected.
Well, but you've provided the evidence, the extraordinary statistical evidence of how devastating these trade deals or globalization in general have been. This is a 40-year-long slow death of the American worker.
Well, it's not just trade. It's also globalization. It's outsourcing. It's robotization, the automation of work. All these have together worked to really undermine the ability of the worker without a college degree to get a decent middle-class level job. All those jobs are the ones that have been first to go. They've gone overseas. They've gone to robots, like you see on automation lines. And they've treaties have encouraged the production of these what these jobs produced to move to China, to move to Vietnam. It's been very difficult for this universe of voters.
And is there any blame to be shared by labor unions, or can you blame labor unions for losing their share of representation of workers? They're down to what, about 7% of private sector workers, aren't they?
They are. And to some extent, blaming is a hard thing to do. What's happened is that economic forces have been at work that unions did not anticipate, whereas business did anticipate these forces. In 1973, business had been an ally, really, of labor. They had worked together. Suddenly, globalization began to make foreign competitors position them to be able to produce the same goods that American companies have been making at lower prices and often in better quality. Management is at that point began to seriously take on labor and fight them tooth and nail instead of working out cooperative agreements, and labor was caught really by surprise. And it's very hard for labor to do something that prevents a company from closing down its American facilities and moving them overseas or to Mexico. Labor has a hard... It can't prevent that management decision. Labor can only really function when the labor force has to be located within the country.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, where he has a recent op-ed, Why Trump Now? So, obviously, you've made a case why, in a sense, the Democrats and the unions can't be blamed entirely for what is turning out to be a major appeal that Donald Trump has with the white working class in America who are coming out in droves in support of him. But surely, just in terms of, I mean, if Hillary, and certainly not Bernie Sanders, but if Hillary somewhat compromised because of the free trade deals that her husband did and that she supported and helped negotiate the TPP, that's very understandable. But, you know, Trump also talks about competitive bidding in the drug industry, which, of course, is a boondoggle that came in during George W. Bush's administration. And he also describes how lobbyists and politicians force the government to buy lousy but expensive airplanes like the F-35, which is a massive, massive turkey and a boondoggle, because of the power of lobbyists and, in effect, the corruption of our politics. These, I think, issues are also resonating. So why not?
You're absolutely right. I think the sense of a corrupt Washington that no longer works in behalf of the voters but works in behalf of really interests, especially wealthy interests that have strong lobbies and contribute a lot of campaign money, That has become almost a conviction among voters. And they see this. If you ask the average voter, is Washington corrupt? A very large percentage would say yes, and in large part for the reasons you just cited.
Well, it seems to me, though, it extends even further, and I guess it extends into what's normally a sacred cow, and that is the Supreme Court, which, of course, is now hanging in the balance since Justice Scalia's death. But I couldn't help noticing that subsequent to Justice Scalia's death, that this huge multinational conglomerate, Dow Chemicals, decided to settle a price-fixing case for close to $1 billion because they'd lost Scalia. So it seems to me that the fix is in terms of corporate America, or all the way through the government into the court, where they're...
Well, it is to some extent. There is a 5-4 majority that has been one of the most pro-business courts ever, by all measures. And that depends on those 5 members being on the court. Without Scalia, it's a 4-4 court. And I'm not sure what the status of the Dow Chemical case was, but if the lower court had ruled against it, they did not have a majority to overturn that decision. The next appointed judge on the court will be, if it is someone who leans to the left, will change this pattern strikingly. Overall, it's been the 5 Republican-appointed judges as opposed to the 4 Democratic-appointed judges that have had this, that have created this strikingly pro-business record. So it's actually that's a case where the partisanship of the appointments has shaped the courts, and this is a moment when the election of 2016 will be crucial in determining what the future direction of the court's going to be.
But of course, the irony is that for all of his championing white working class and tapping into their anger, Donald Trump, if he were president, would probably make an appointment more along the Republican lines, more corporatist, I would suggest, than in the interest of his white working class voters. That's just a supposition, but I'm basing that to some extent on your conclusion in your article at the New York Times, Thomas Edsel, Why Trump Now, where you basically say he's tapping into this anger, and these people have legitimate grievances, but Donald Trump is going to take them on a fool's errand.
I think that's quite likely. It's very hard to predict who he would appoint, and a part of that would depend on whether the Democrats take over the Senate again. That's the other crucial thing, because the Senate has to approve the judge. But you're probably right that Trump would pick a pro-business appointee to the court. I think that's the odds are on that, yes.
So one of the things, though, that I thought was so striking, and the video went viral, and it completely supports what you have written about Thomas Edsel in terms of how Trump has tapped into these legitimate grievances that working Americans have. I don't know whether you saw this video of the executive from Carrier, the big air conditioning company that were moving to Mexico, and he was addressing the workers in this kind of corporate language about why the corporation had to stay competitive and the extremely price-sensitive marketplace and all of this sort of double talk, corporate double talk. And the workers standing there who are all getting fired, one of them shouted out, F you, to the executive. And the executive then turns around and asks the workers to please be quiet so that he can share his information with them. I mean, yeah. It was just absolutely outrageous. And it makes you wonder about what happened to our society. You mentioned earlier that there was a kind of compact between corporate America and the unions not so long ago, you know, back in the 1970s. What happened to the idea that we're all sort of in it together, if you will? Is there just simply no such thing as a social contract anymore in this country?
I think the social contract has been really wrecked by competition. The competitive pressure, it used to be, for example, that the automobile industry, before there was global competition, Ford could agree to a set wage, and that would become the pattern for General Motors and for Chrysler. And so wages did not affect competition. It was the people would buy cars on what they thought was a better car. Now, with global competition, all three major automobile manufacturers have to compete with foreign producers, and suddenly labor becomes a competitive factor in determining price. And that has made a cooperative or a social compact set of agreements virtually impossible when basically the market has become much more brutal and has forced much more brutal choices on corporate America.
So what's the explanation then for why Trump, I mean, they've both drawn big crowds, but Trump has clearly dominated the media. Is it because he's just more skillful at what they call earned media coverage, or is there a bias that Bernie Sanders' message is not as popular with corporate America than Trump's, which is hard to believe? But what would the explanation be?
I think that Trump, if you look at the current campaign, both Sanders and Trump have been disruptive of the past order. But Trump has been successful in being more disruptive. He's now the lead candidate, Bernie Sanders has shown more strength than expected, but he does not look as if he could actually make it to become the nominee, whereas Trump does. So to some extent, the attention on Trump is based on the likelihood that he will be that he will be the nominee, whereas Sanders has been getting a lot of attention, and it's quite striking. He hasn't really broken through to the point where people take him seriously as a probable nominee.
Well, I suppose the one thing that's pretty clear, Thomas Edsel, is that Hillary Clinton is in trouble, right? I mean, not only is she having, I mean, everybody seems to say she's a shoo-in, but she was having a pretty tough time with Bernie Sanders in the recent debate, even though most of the punditry awarded the debate, if you will, to Hillary. And you mentioned earlier she's going to have a hard time against Trump because of these trade deals. And Bernie, of course, has been painting her into the corner of being, you know, something of a favorite of Wall Street's, if not being compromised by Wall Street. And there's no question that the 2008 financial collapse is still an open wound, is it not, with working Americans? And certainly Bernie Sanders is the one that puts it, I think, in a more accurate context. But do you think that Trump, being this sort of New Yorker, et cetera, with all of his Wall Street friends, is he a suitable candidate to reform Wall Street?
Oh, I doubt very much that he is a suitable candidate. He is, you know, his business connections, though, are really in real estate, hotels, and so forth. He's not an investor or a banker like Wall Street interests are.
Sure.
But there's not a complete overlap with him. However, I fully agree that Hillary is showing a lot of weaknesses and vulnerabilities that are going to make her, if she, assuming she gets the nomination, are going to make it far more competitive than one would expect with an opponent like Trump or Cruz. Either one of those two should be beatable by a relatively large margin. She carries burdens that would be that just make her a weaker candidate.
Well, I was more or less referring to Carl Icahn, who Trump more or less talks as he's the kind of guy that he would take his advice from, if not put in the cabinet. But in general, I think the main point that you make in your article, Thomas Edsel, at the New York Times, Why Trump Now, is that voter anger is directed at two targets, the undeserving rich and the undeserving poor.
Yeah, that's in a sense, when you're trying to mobilize the white working class, being able to do a two-pronged campaign mobilizing anger up and anger down, that is an effective tool. And in fact, Bernie Sanders mobilizes anger up, but he does not, and no Democrat really would, but try to focus anger down on what they see as the undeserving poor. But for Trump, it's an effective means of pulling in a lot of votes, as he's been doing.
But just in closing, though, the statistics that you have in your article at the New York Times, Why Trump Now, Thomas Edsel, do indicate that over these four decades of globalism eviscerating the white working class and jobs in this country with outsourcing, etc., there's also been a concurrent huge uptick in emigration into the country. So that's the dog whistle that Trump is using, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people feel, rightly or wrongly, that one of the reasons why their pay is going down and why there aren't as many jobs available to them is that they're competing with immigrants who are willing to, who will take lower wages and have taken away jobs in many cases. That's, and again, that is a political tool that Trump is clearly very willing to use, whereas Bernie Sanders would not use that, nor would Hillary Clinton. But that's to some extent, been a Republican tool for quite a few years. Now it's with Trump, it's wide open.
Well, Thomas Edsel, I thank you very much for joining us. And
my pleasure.
I hope we can stay in touch. Obviously, there's a long road ahead, and I just wonder if at some point or other the horrible nature of this race so far will perhaps create a fatigue factor. But here we are both talking about it, so we're getting sucked in no matter what we think, right?
No question. Yep.
Well, thank you for joining us.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, and he is the author of The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity, and he has a recent op-ed at the New York Times, Why Trump Now? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into why all of a sudden there are millions of socialists in America.
Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working band blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul. Tossed by the winds and the seas, I'll drag them all.
She's so good to me, and I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down that way.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Harold Meyerson, an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. His latest article at The Guardian is Why Are There Suddenly Millions of Socialists in America? Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Meyerson.
Good to be here, Ian.
And indeed, it is a bit of an extraordinary event, isn't it? How the S word has lost all of its pejorative value in such a short time in America.
It is. I think there are actually two things that have been sort of brewing for a while but have only become clear in this election. One is the degree of white working class anger that we see mainly, though not entirely, in the Trump campaign. The other is a move left on the part of most Democrats, and particularly the young, so that the stigma attached to socialism, by which I think most of them mean the social democracy we associate with Western and Northern Europe, that the stigma associated with that has dwindled, and as American capitalism has been not performing very well for most Americans, more Americans are willing to embrace that label.
And in your article at The Guardian, Why Are There Suddenly Millions of Socialists in America?, you point out that a 2011 Pew poll indicated 49% of Americans under 30 have a positive view of socialism, while just 47% have a favorable opinion of capitalism. Those findings would suggest that Bernie Sanders did not push young people towards socialism, but they were already there. So is this what happens when you live at home, when you're laden with student debt and you can't get a job?
Apparently it is. Apparently it is. I mean, you know, since the beginning of the 20th century, a lot of academics and others have sort of pondered why America never had a socialist movement, unlike any other industrialized country, that really amounted to anything. And the first person to write about that, a German sociologist named Werner Sombart, who wrote in 1906, the famous essay entitled Why Is There No Socialism in the United States, basically concluded that you had immigrants coming over from Europe and then working in pretty crummy factories. But it was better than what they left. It was a higher level of material prosperity, even though it may not have been much. And his famous sentence was that on the reefs of roast beef and apple pie, all socialist utopias smash up. Well, there's clearly tens of millions of Americans who don't feel that they're encountering whatever the 21st century version of roast beef and apple pie is at this moment. They are living at home with their parents. They're saddled with student debt. the economy generates jobs, but disproportionately they're really crummy, low-paying jobs. And that kind of thing extended over a number of years can make you question whether the economic system we have really makes a lot of sense.
Well, of course, one of the great ironies, not in terms of American socialism, but in terms of American exceptionalism, that term apparently was coined by none other than Joseph Stalin, not in praise of America, but rather that the puzzlement that communists had as to why they couldn't get any traction in the United States.
That's right. It is a Stalin coinage, which is amusing given that it sort of become common parlance at all points in the political spectrum that have nothing to do with Joseph Stalin. So that's true. It's just another expression of this anomaly in American life. Now, it's also true that while you're seeing polls showing lots of Americans coming out for the Democratic primaries and caucuses who, when asked, say, okay, I'm a socialist, it's also true that that doesn't mean there's a socialist movement. And a presidential campaign is not the same thing as a movement. I remember Michael Harrington, the American socialist leader of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, used to say an organized socialism is a contradiction in terms. Well, in that case, America has lots of contradictions walking around today.
And again, I'm speaking with Harold Meyerson, who's an editor-at-large at the American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post. His latest article at The Guardian is Why Are There Suddenly Millions of Socialists in America? But to pick up on what you said, Harold, in terms of a movement, do you see if Bernie Sanders doesn't make it and Hillary does, which is what most of the prognosticators indicate, then could he, short of being her vice president, and apparently the punditry indicates that she will make a more conventional choice like the head of HUD, one of the Castro brothers or twins, or even somebody out of the box, as they say, Elizabeth Warren, but not necessarily Bernie Sanders. So would he be able to create and carry on this movement that even though, as you pointed out in your article, socialism was there before Bernie tapped into it, but nevertheless, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's hard to make the transition from an election campaign to any kind of ongoing organization or movement. I mean, Jesse Jackson had the Rainbow Coalition, Howard Dean had Democracy for America, and Obama had Obama for America, which has been through several iterations since. But none of these really became a notably vibrant or independent movement. I think it is going to require a good deal of thought and action by some of the folks involved in the Sanders campaign to try to build something that lasts, which has to be independent of, I think, Bernie Sanders and of the Sanders campaign. I mean, there are some institutions which are taking a role in the Sanders campaign. There are two major unions, communication workers and nurses, that have really involved themselves in his campaign. And there's an organization called the Working Families Party, whose name is kind of a misnomer. It really sort of functions as a left wing of the Democratic Party, but has built real independent political power where it's been most active, which is New York, and is beginning to do so in several other eastern and midwestern states. They've endorsed Sanders, too. So something has to emerge which is, I think, independent of Bernie, but builds on, all of the mobilization that campaign has engendered.
Well, just to use an historical analogy to try and sort of raise a puzzlement as to why it's difficult to transition or how spontaneous political movements tend to die because of electoral politics or when electoral politics take over. Look what happened in the 60s and 70s with the Vietnam War. A massive social movement took place. Now, to some extent, the young people involved did have skin in the game because of the draft, but nevertheless, it was a powerful political movement, much more pervasive and powerful than those that are flocking to both Bernie's banner and Donald Trump's banner. But the minute that Nixon ended the war, that whole movement went away. So what explains that? Is there something about the U.S. that we're so wedded to the two parties and, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, that we can't move beyond that?
Well, the American electoral system really makes it hard for a third party to get any traction because there's no proportional representation. And so if you have a party either to the left or the right of one of the main parties, or even a party in the middle, you tend to hurt the party that is closer to you, by going into that new party. And you know, as made clear by sort of the Ralph Nader effort in 2000, that can come at a real cost. And so that's a real issue. But let me kind of get back to the Vietnam War for a minute. While you're right that the anti-war movement as such, didn't really have any particular legs itself after Nixon ended the draft, the generation of young people who got involved in the presidential campaigns of Gene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy and George McGovern in 1968 and 1972, pretty much those who, stayed within the Democratic Party as activists, gave the party a kind of, non-interventionist foreign policy for quite some time to come, and had ongoing fights with sort of this, I can get into the realms of historical obscurity here, Hubert Humphrey's Henry Jackson Democrats, who were more hawkish, and some of whom ended up as neoconservatives going to work for Reagan. But so there was a kind of attenuated legacy of the anti-war movement through the opposition of Democrats to things like intervention in Nicaragua and things like that over the 20 years following the Vietnam War.
Well, then, could you make the case that there's a natural coalition out there? That is, the people you're talking about, the anti-war protesters of the 60s and 70s, the baby boomers, whose children are the millennials flocking to Bernie's banner.
Well, to a degree, yeah, although there's no question that age is a real determinant on how people are voting in the Democratic primaries this year. Obviously, Bernie does very well among young people, and even among minority young people. Even if he doesn't carry a majority of them, he still is running, 20, 30 points better among young people than among older people. I think there's a distinct experience that young people have had in the current economy that makes them question the economy, perhaps en masse, more than their elders. They also, don't have, when they think about socialism, they came of age after Soviet communism disappeared. And there may be just a tendency on the part of older people to see Hillary as more electable and then back her. So there really is an age gap. I'm not so sure that most of the once left parents or even grandparents are with their kids this time around, though obviously some are.
Well, in terms of, though, the critique of capitalism, that Bernie Sanders' campaign, he's mostly talking about what Wall Street did to the economy and how Wall Street creamed Main Street and how Main Street brought back Wall Street and got nothing in return, and they're now even too bigger to fail and more arrogant and more powerful than ever. In many ways, though, the interesting thing about FDR was that he saved capitalism in spite of how he was vilified by the capitalists. And much of what Bernie Sanders is saying actually would improve capitalism, if not save it, because at the end of the day, it's a self-serving casino that they've got on Wall Street that's all about extracting wealth and not creating wealth. Whereas, for example, we talked about the young people living at home. If you were able to get rid of their student debt, as Bernie says, then they'd be able to purchase cars and refrigerators and homes, which in our economy, the 70% dependent upon consumption, certainly would be a boost.
Absolutely, as would raising the minimum wage, as would changing labor law so people can join unions again without fear of being fired, which is a major obstacle to the growth of unions. There are all kinds of things that not just Bernie, but actually most mainstream Democrats, but Bernie in particular, would do that would make the economy much more vibrant, because you're right, 70% of the gross domestic product is consumption, and Americans are under-consuming because Americans lack income. So, yes, there needs to be a redistribution to get the capitalist economy functioning better, no question about it.
Well, just in closing, Harold Meyerson, It does seem that Donald Trump is running away with so many Democratic issues, all issues that the Democrats should be concerned about, the boondoggles like the F-35 fighter, defense contractors waste billions because of lobbyists and bought off politicians. Also, of course, trade. He brings it up all the time. And Hillary is, of course, compromised because of NAFTA and TPP. But in general, I can foresee in a general election, either against Trump against Hillary or Trump against Bernie, he could suddenly come out with this, you know, major policy plan to reinvent America and save its crumbling infrastructure, something that should have been done over the last decade but for obstruction from the Republicans because interest rates are so low that you could borrow money cheaply. But does it worry you that the Democrats are just not – they're not getting ahead of Trump?
Well, I mean, Bernie is on those issues, but I don't think Bernie's going to be the nominee. On trade, I think he really strikes a chord, in addition to other chords, which I very much and you very much disagree with, among the white working class. And I think that would tend to activate, for Republicans, a vote they don't usually get. And that would bring out, you know, that would probably put the states of the former industrial Midwest into play, Western Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, which is reliably Republican anyway, Michigan, Wisconsin. You know, so that would be a problem for the Democrats. On the other hand, there would be a huge minority turnout, particularly Latino, against Trump, Asian Americans too, and I think there would be a lot of upper middle class professional Republicans who wouldn't vote for him. So it could be a bit of a trade off, but there's no question that he would be stronger than any Republican has been in a very, very long time in the Rust Belt.
But in the broader sense, bringing America back, as he keeps saying, nobody's come up with a plan to put people to work. You know, you have to go back to Eisenhower's highway plan that, in terms of infrastructure, that, of course, was done under the rubric of defense.
Well, both Bernie and Hillary do have infrastructure proposals. Hillary's is at about $300 billion, and Bernie's is about $1 trillion, both of those over a decade. So I think they're there on that, but, you know, Obama's had one, too, and you just can't get anything through a Republican Congress since he got the stimulus through when the Democrats really did have a majority. So, it's going to be a difficult debate, I think, with Hillary as a nominee. I mean, she does have some somewhat decent proposals, not as much as Bernie there. But Trump has, he's not stated any dollar figure, but, you know, his whole aura is someone who can get things built, get Americans employed. Of course, you know, Trump is actually opposed to the minimum wage and has never said word one about anyone getting paid a union wage on any of this, so we shall see.
Right.
But it's going to be hard for the forces that traditionally try to mobilize in those states, unions in particular, to try to get working class votes to go to the Democrat as opposed to Trump, white working class votes, I should emphasize.
Well, Harold Meyerson, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Harold Meyerson, who's an editor-at-large of The American Prospect and a weekly columnist for The Washington Post, and he has an article at The Guardian, Why Are There Suddenly Millions of Socialists in America? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.